Tonight, we present the 16th Annual Lincoln Legacy Lectures with a program titled Lincoln versus Douglas. And like all of you here tonight, I am looking forward to this evening's presentations by our distinguished speakers. As many of you know, the Lincoln Legacy Lecture Series was inaugurated in 2002 to bring scholars and policy experts of national renown to share their expertise with us. Unique to this series is that each topic addressed in the lecture series over this past 16 years is one that both engaged Abraham Lincoln and the citizens of his era at the same time that topic has relevance today. That is certainly the case with this evening's presentations. The Lincoln Legacy Lecture event is sponsored by the UIS Center for Lincoln Studies. And that's the first time I've gotten to say that into a microphone, so that was really fun. Let me say that one more time. The Lincoln Legacy Lecture Series event is sponsored by the UIS Center for Lincoln Studies in cooperation with the Chancellor Naomi Lynn Distinguished Chair in Lincoln Studies. This year's co-sponsors also include the Abraham Lincoln Association, the Brookins Library John Holtz Memorial Lecture, the Illinois State Historical Society, the Illinois State Library, the Looking for Lincoln Heritage Coalition, NPR Illinois, the Springfield branch of the NAACP, the UIS Colleges of Liberal Arts and Sciences, Business and Management, Education and Human Services, and Public Affairs and Administration, the UIS Center for State Policy and Leadership, and the UIS Office of Advancement. We also offer our sincere thanks to Mary Beaumont, David and Lori Farrell, and Jim and Linda Gobberdeel for their generous support of the Lincoln Legacy Lecture. These lectures have brought many accomplished scholars to UIS over the years to examine various aspects of Lincoln's legacy. We will hear from two this evening, as well as from our own distinguished Lincoln scholar. I want to express my personal welcome to Graham Peck and Roger Bridges, who will be introduced shortly, for being with us this evening. Thank you so much, gentlemen. There is no doubt that Springfield, Illinois is the hub of the universe for Lincoln scholarship. That makes the University of Illinois Springfield uniquely positioned to provide leadership for Lincoln Studies. And that, of course, is the reason we are launching this year the UIS Center for Lincoln Studies. As we continue to plan this new center, we are building on the rich history at UIS of collaboration with partners like the Illinois Historic Preservation Agency, the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum, the Abraham Lincoln Association, the Illinois State Historical Society, and other organizations that are helping us to deepen Lincoln scholarship, enrich the student experience here at the University of Illinois, and advance the public's knowledge of Abraham Lincoln and his legacy. The Naomi Lynn Lincoln Scholar, the Lincoln Legacy Lecture Series, and our beautiful sculpture of Mr. Lincoln, The Young Lawyer, by sculptor George Lundeen, add to the foundation for even more activities and collaborations related to Abraham Lincoln. And by the way, if you haven't taken a selfie yet with Mr. Lincoln on our campus, I hope you will sometime soon. It might be too dark by the time this is over, so you'll have to come back. But this is what everyone does here. So if you haven't done that yet, you need to do that. Well, we're so fortunate, of course, to have Lincoln's example of political courage and moral character as lessons of leadership to offer to our students and to reflect upon ourselves as citizens. It is now my honor to introduce the moderator for this evening, who will provide opening remarks and introduce tonight's distinguished program. Dr. Michael Burlingame is an internationally renowned Lincoln scholar who holds the Chancellor Naomi B. Lynn Distinguished Chair in Lincoln Studies here at UIS. A graduate of Princeton University who earned his PhD in history from Johns Hopkins University, Dr. Burlingame joined the University of Illinois Springfield faculty in 2009 after completing his prize-winning two-volume biography, Abraham Lincoln, A Life, for the Lincoln Bicentennial. The recipient of many awards and accolades for his scholarship, Dr. Burlingame was inducted into the Lincoln Academy of Illinois in 2009. Dr. Burlingame is a beloved and tireless teacher, scholar, author, and public speaker, whose eloquence on the life and legacy of Abraham Lincoln is unrivaled. I am both proud and grateful to call him a colleague and a dear friend. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Michael Burlingame.
Well, thank you for that very kind introduction, Chancellor. And thank you all for coming. Before I introduce our distinguished speakers, I would like to share with you some preliminary thoughts about our subject. And note that in the voluminous literature about Lincoln and race, there is surprisingly little about his relation with individual African Americans. That is, how he treated them, how they regarded him. An examination of his interaction with blacks here in Springfield and later in Washington, D.C., with servants, with guests at White House receptions, with callers at the Executive Mansion, with residents of refugee camps, with workers at Washington hospitals and others, shows that Lincoln treated them the same way he treated Frederick Douglass, who said of Lincoln, quote, "In his company, I was never in any way reminded of my humble origin or of my unpopular color." Frederick Douglass also spoke of Lincoln's, quote, "kindly disposition towards colored people in general and not just toward him." Professor Clarence Luzon, an African-American historian at American University in Washington, D.C., noted in his recent book, The Black History of the White House, that during Lincoln's presidency, quote, "political access to the White House had been extended to the black community for the first time in American history." In addition to luminaries like Frederick Douglass and Sojourner Truth, quote, "many lesser known activists and ordinary African Americans met with him there as well." The significance of these encounters cannot be overstated. The multiracial space that Lincoln opened would be a critical new element in the ongoing struggle for black freedom and equality. Now, those encounters constitute a revealing story which time does not allow us to explore now in depth. This evening, I would like briefly to focus on just one example of Lincoln's interaction with a black man whom he knew here in Springfield and in Washington, D.C., and that is William H. Johnson, a servant who accompanied the Lincoln family on its rail journey from here to the nation's capital in 1861. Not much is known about Johnson's time here in Springfield, other than that he began working at the Lincoln home early in 1860. Now, even the distinguished local historian of Springfield in Lincoln's time, Richard Hart, has been unable to find much about Johnson. If he can't find it, it doesn't exist. Is that right, Dick? Okay. Now, Johnson first enters the historical record while on that train trip. A journalist aboard the train described Johnson as, quote, "a very useful member of the presidential party whose untiring vigilance as he took care of the party was entitled to high credit." Once he arrived in Washington, Johnson began working at the Executive Mansion as a porter and a presidential valet. But the other African-American employees in the White House, all light-skinned, objected to his dark complexion. According to a black historian who interviewed African-Americans employed at the Lincoln White House, the appointment of Johnson, and I quote, "almost caused an open rebellion because of a social distinction. Johnson's color was very dark, and the White House servants were always light. He was mistreated in such a way that it became necessary for Lincoln to look elsewhere for employment for him. And by the way, parenthetically, the long-standing tendency of light-skinned African American blacks to look down upon dark-skinned blacks has recently been denominated colorism, that is, prejudice based on color. Now, 3 days after his inauguration, Lincoln gave Johnson a letter of recommendation. Quote, to whom it may concern, William Johnson, a colored boy and bearer of this, has been with me about 12 months and has been, so far as I believe, honest, faithful, sober, industrious, and handy as a servant. A few days later, Lincoln wrote to Navy Secretary Gideon Welles and said, the bearer, William, is a servant who has been with me for some time and in whom I have confidence as to his integrity and faithfulness. He wishes to enter your service. The difference of color between him and the other servants is the cause of our separation. If you can give him employment, you will confer a favor upon yours truly. Nothing came of that overture. In November 1861, the president appealed more successfully to Treasury Secretary Salmon P. Chase, saying, you remember kindly asking me some time ago whether I really desired you to find a place for William Johnson, a colored boy who came from Illinois with me. If you can find him a place, I shall be really obliged. In response, the very next day, Chase appointed Johnson to a $600 per year job in his department, acting as a messenger for the Treasury Department's librarian. To enable Johnson to earn more money, the president facilitated his efforts to moonlight for others, and Johnson continued to work at the White House as Lincoln's barber, valet, and body man. He spent his mornings in the White House and his afternoons at the nearby Treasury Department building. Occasionally, Lincoln gave him checks for small amounts to supplement his modest salary. In October 1862, Lincoln again wrote a letter of recommendation for Johnson. The bearer of this, William Johnson Colored, came with me from Illinois and is a worthy man, as I believe. 2 months later, he penned a memorandum referring to Johnson's desire to get permission to go to Norfolk. And so a letter was drafted to General Dix, who would have been in charge of the railroads, and so saying, let Johnson go, don't bother him. And Lincoln had, one of his secretaries had drafted this letter, and Lincoln didn't like it. And he said, I declined to sign the within document because it does not state the thing quite to my liking. The colored man, William Johnson, came with me from Illinois, and I would be glad for him to be obliged if he can be, consistently with the public service. But I cannot make an order about it, nor a request which might, in some sense, be construed as an order. In November 1863, Lincoln requested that Johnson be given time off from his Treasury Department job in order to accompany him on his historic journey to Gettysburg. Soon after they returned to Washington from Pennsylvania, Johnson, like Lincoln, was laid low by smallpox, which sidelined the president for 3 weeks and which killed Johnson in January 1864. One day that month, January, as Johnson lay in his hospital sickbed, a journalist discovered Lincoln counting out greenbacks, the dollar bills, and placing them in envelopes. He explained that such an activity, quote, is something out of my usual line, but a president of the United States has a multiplicity of duties not specified in the Constitution or Acts of Congress. This is one of them. This money belongs to a poor Negro, that is Johnson, who is a porter in one of the departments, that is the Treasury, and who is at present very bad with the smallpox. He did not catch it from me, however, at least I think not. He is now in hospital and could not draw his pay because he could not sign his name. I have been at considerable trouble to overcome the difficulty and to get it for him, and have at length succeeded in cutting red tape. I am now dividing the money and putting a portion in an envelope with my own hands according to his wish. Now, to purchase a house, Johnson had borrowed money from the First National Bank of Washington using Lincoln as a guarantor. After Johnson died, the bank's cashier, William Huntington, happened to mention the outstanding notes to Lincoln. "The barber who used to shave you, I hear, is dead," said Huntington. "Oh, yes," interrupted the president with feeling. "William is gone. I bought a coffin for the poor fellow and have had to help his family." When Huntington said the bank would forgive the loan, Lincoln replied emphatically, "No, no, no, you don't. I endorse the notes and am bound to pay them, and it is your duty to make me pay them." "Yes," said the banker, "but it has long been our custom to devote a portion of our profits to charitable objects, and this seems to be a most deserving one." When the president rejected that argument, Huntington said, "Well, Mr. Lincoln, I will tell you how we can arrange this. The loan to William was a joint one between you and the bank. You stand half of the loss, and I will cancel the other." After thinking it over, Lincoln said, "No, no, Mr. Huntington, that sounds fair, but it is insidious. You are going to get ahead of me. You are going to give me the smallest note to pay. There must be a fair division over poor William. Reckon up the interest on both notes and chop the whole right straight through the middle so that my half shall be just as big as yours. That's the way we will fix it." Huntington agreed, saying, "After this, Mr. President, you can never deny that you endorse the Negro." "That's a fact," Lincoln exclaimed with a laugh, "but I don't intend to deny it." Now, it is not clear just where William Johnson was buried. Some claim that Lincoln ordered him interred at Arlington Cemetery, but the evidence is inconclusive. With an equal lack of evidence, some also assert Lincoln paid for his headstone, upon which was engraved "William Johnson, Citizen." That gesture supposedly helps show that Lincoln regarded blacks as citizens. But the designation "citizen" is found on many gravestones in the cemetery area where Johnson is purportedly buried. And that word was simply the equivalent of "civilian," as opposed to "military veteran." So it had not the larger significance that some attribute to it. The story of Lincoln's relationship with William Johnson does, however, shed light on the president's humanity and his racial egalitarianism. Now, some may object that by twice referring to Johnson in writing as "boy," Lincoln demonstrated something less than full respect for Johnson. But the president also referred to him in writing twice as "man," indicating that in Lincoln's mind, "boy" did not have the pejorative meaning that we associate with it. Moreover, Lincoln's willingness to bring Johnson to Washington from Springfield to guarantee his mortgage, to pay for his coffin, to help his family financially, to try to find him gainful employment after he had become the victim of colorism on the part of African Americans working in the White House, and to tangle with the bureaucracy to get his pay voucher and distribute it speaks volumes. As the knowledgeable Lincoln authority, James Cornelius of Springfield — James, where are you? Okay, there's our knowledgeable Lincoln authority. He wrote in a recent piece on Lincoln and Johnson, and I think there's a lot of truth in this, "How a man treats another man in private may tell us far more than his public utterances about groups." So, now, we are very fortunate tonight to have these two gentlemen to address us. This year, as Illinois celebrates its 200th birthday as a state, it seemed appropriate to emphasize Lincoln's Illinois roots by inviting two Illinois-based, Illinois-educated authorities on Illinois history about Lincoln in the context of the politics and culture of the Prairie State. Dr. Roger D. Bridges, who is nearer to me, of Bloomington, received his PhD in history at the University of Illinois Satellite Campus in Champaign-Urbana after having done his undergraduate work and his master's studies at Northern Iowa, which I believe is our chancellor's alma mater. Okay. Dr. Bridges has written extensively on both Illinois history and on Abraham Lincoln. He has served as director of research at the Illinois State Historical Library, which is now known as the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library, and later as the overall director of that institution. He has also served as director of the Lincoln Legal Papers Project, as executive director of the Rutherford B. Hayes Presidential Library and Museums in Fremont, Ohio, as well as president of the Abraham Lincoln Association here in Springfield. He has long been at work on a history of African Americans in Illinois. With Rodney O. Davis, he edited Illinois, Its History and Legacy, a volume of essays including his own on blacks in a white society. Now to his right, Professor Graham Peck, a member of the history department at St. Xavier University in Chicago, received his PhD in history from Northwestern University. His book, Making an Anti-Slavery Nation, Lincoln, Douglas, and the Battle Over Freedom, which was published by the University of Illinois Press last year, won the Illinois State Historical Society's Russell P. Strange Memorial Book Award, given annually in recognition of an author's significant contribution to the body and study of Illinois history. Professor Peck also wrote, directed, and produced Stephen A. Douglas and the Fate of American Democracy, a feature-length film that was broadcast on Chicago's PBS station and is installed as a permanent exhibit at the Douglas Tomb State Historic Site in Chicago. In addition to courses in American history, he teaches filmmaking at St. Xavier. So please let us welcome these two fine gentlemen.
Thank you, Michael, for that very fine introduction. Tonight, I'm going to talk about the darker side, and no pun intended, of Illinois history during the Lincoln era. On January 4th, 1865, 3 days after the second anniversary of Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, Representative Ambrose H. Miller of Logan County moved that the Committee on the Judiciary be instructed to report a bill amendatory of the Black Laws, now in force, to effectually prohibit the immigration of free persons of color to and settling in the state. It is important, he claimed, to strengthen the existing law to stem the constant influx of free persons of color into our state. The influx, he insisted, was an insult to the soldiers who had left the fields of labor to save the Union, but would soon find the jobs they left filled by former slaves. Further, the state must prevent the baneful effects of mixing the races to maintain the dignity of white labor from the degrading effects of blacks and to maintain the purity of the blood. This statement encapsulates the opinion of many Illinoisans, even at the close of the Civil War. That same day, Senator John D. Lansing of Peoria introduced a bill to repeal certain statutes known as the Black Laws. His Egyptian colleague, Senator William Green of Alexander County, as you know, that's down there in Egypt, who still considered African Americans as property, and he objected on the grounds that it was unconstitutional, there being no laws on the statute books called the Black Laws, and of course he was right. The editors of the Illinois State Register, as the General Assembly was posed to repeal the Black Laws, wrote, "So far the passage of this heinous law was defeated." Speaking of the repeal of the Black Laws. "It was an atrocious attempt to wipe from our statutes the distinction which the Creator himself has so far failed. Fanaticism may triumph, but we call upon the ever-conservative Republican, small r, to aid the righteous exertion of the white man to preserve the distinction fixed by the Almighty himself against the amalgamation of the races." Amalgamation was the term we now use for miscegenation. Indeed, as Dana Elizabeth Weiner has observed, when most Midwestern Americans read in an individual the signs of blackness, the meaning they assigned to African ancestry justified discriminatory treatment. This racism was one that was particularly pervasive in the Old Northwest, of course, of which Illinois is a part. In the most extreme form, she says, racist logic utterly dehumanized African Americans in their contemporaries' eyes. Well, in addition to the constitutional and legal barriers demonstrating the apparent racism present among whites in Illinois was a prevalent use of the N-word by Illinois newspapers. In a quick keyword search of Illinois newspapers found on genealogy.com, I found the N-word used at least 2,400 times, and I would guess it was probably used twice as many times. And in addition, the term darky or darkies was used another 600 or more times. Long before Illinois became a state, slaveholding was common. It is uncertain when the first black slaves arrived in Illinois, but they are first mentioned in 1720 at Kaskaskia with the Jesuits. And from then until 1765, when the British took control, slavery flourished in the Illinois country and increased from a few souls to nearly 1,000. While the British and the Americans after 1778 assured the French settlers their property would be safe, French colonists began moving their slaves across the Mississippi to Spanish Missouri. Thus, the population of African Americans in Illinois declined significantly. According to most authorities, however, the slaves of the French colonists had more rights than slaves later had under the British and the Americans. As example, under the French Code Noir, black slaves were allowed to marry in the church, and even interracial marriages were permitted. They were given one day off per week. They were allowed to sue their owners for cruelty, and slave children were baptized in the church, instructed in the Catholic faith, and blacks were buried in consecrated cemeteries if they were Catholic. Slave conditions worsened under the British control between 1765 and 1778 when George Rogers Clark of Virginia conquered the Illinois country and it became a Virginia county. They were now considered by most people as simply chattels, a status they remained to hold for the next several years. With the close of the American Revolution, the creation of a new nation, Virginia ceded its claims to the lands north and west of the Ohio River. In ceding those claims, they insisted that the French and Canadian inhabitants and other settlers of the Kaskaskia, St. Vincent's, and neighboring villages who have professed themselves citizens of Virginia who shall have their possessions and titles confirmed to them and protected in the enjoyment of their rights and liberties. The Northwest Ordinance, passed by Congress in 1787, outlawed slavery in this region, but whether it ended slavery was left ambiguous. When anxious slaveholders in the territory inquired of Governor Arthur St. Clair, he declared that taking their property, meaning slaves, would be an ex post facto action, and therefore they were safe. Consequently, during the entire period, territorial period, slavery was practiced in the territory. But because many feared that they would lose their human property anyway, they memorialized and petitioned Congress to repeal or suspend the sixth article of the Northwest Ordinance, which reads, "There shall be neither slavery nor involuntary servitude in said territory, otherwise than in the punishment of crimes, whereof the party shall have been convicted." But in a caveat that many of us never noticed, it goes on to say, provided always that any person escaping into the same from whom labor or service is lawfully claimed such fugitives may be lawfully reclaimed and conveyed to the person claiming his or her labor or service as aforesaid. This clause was later clarified by the Fugitive Slave Act of 1793. During the Indiana era, Indiana developed the Black Codes for that region, regulating the conduct of free and slave African Americans and their masters. In addition, it introduced a system of involuntary servitude, euphemistically called indentured servitude. In 1809, when Illinois was set off as a separate territory, the slaveholders who had migrated to the territory, many of them from the South, with their slaves, now began to convert their slaves to indentured servants, who would serve from 1 to 99 years. And they would freely enter into these indentures. If you believe that, I've got a bridge in Brooklyn I'd like to sell you. If the slaves did not agree to this indenture, they could be returned to the state from which they came and sold or held in servitude anyway by somebody else. All contracts had to be with indentured servants had to be registered with the county in which they were, and the free blacks who were already in the territory also had to register so that everybody knew who and where they were. Illinois leaders were comfortable with this quasi-slaveholding society, but they did not want free blacks around anyway. In 1813, the Illinois Territorial Legislature prohibited the immigration of free African Americans into Illinois. When Illinois became a state in 1818, with a population slightly in excess of 40,000, maybe, there are some who say it didn't have 40,000. They had that the black population was somewhere between 900 and 1,100 as servants and slaves. Its constitution, the Illinois Constitution, then forbade future slavery, ignored existing slavery, but allowed slaves to be imported for 1 year's labor in the salt works in southeastern Illinois. There were several reasons for this leniency on slavery. Many believed the richness of the Illinois soil required slave labor in order to create a viable agricultural economy. Others asserted that because the Illinois territory was jointly owned by the United States, therefore all slave property should be protected. Slavery's opponents, however, saw it as a threat to free labor, and others simply did not want to live with African Americans around. In 1819, the state increased its oppression of African Americans by adopting a new law concerning Negroes and mulattoes. It prohibited bringing slaves into the state for manumission, again required free blacks to provide certificates of freedom, which must be filed with the county, and that prohibited black indentured servants from bringing suits against citizens and or testifying against them. Reacting to these harsh measures, in the summer of 1822, a group of African Americans in Madison County circulated an eloquent petition requesting the right of suffrage. They charged and requested, and here I'm going to quote this petition, that, "Woeful to relate, and in a free country too, we are the objects of rapine, plunder, and devastation to freebooters. Our property, dear as it is to us, is as dust and trash when put in competition with carrying us away by force of arms, kidnapping, into perpetual slavery, us and our offspring that we have raised so tenderly by the sweat of our brows. But we, the free Negroes, it is well known that neither our forefathers nor their offspring have originally been intruders. But here we are, and here we intend to stay. and would be happy in case we could partake of the blessings of our incomparable representative government, for which favor we now supplicate your honorable body, that all freemen of us, 21 years of age and upwards, may be entitled to vote for and in the same manner that the law allows your white population to. George Churchill introduced this petition, although he didn't really agree with it, praying for the right of suffrage, and it was quickly forwarded to the Judiciary Committee of the Senate. The Select Committee then rejected the petition, insisting that the Constitution could do all that could already be done for them. The committee pointed out with pride that future slavery had been prohibited, and the only slaves still existing in Illinois were those present when the territory was ceded to the United States. The report noted the promise that all property rights would be protected. And of course, we know what property rights are talking about. Then in its conclusion, the committee recommended that a new constitutional convention be called, a call that the Illinoisans saw as a call to make Illinois a slave state. At this point, many insisted that as a sovereign state, equal in all rights to the existing states, its citizens could adopt slavery if they wished. And this question dominated the gubernatorial election of 1822, won by Edward Coles, the anti-slavery candidate. Edward Coles was born in Virginia on a plantation. He inherited slaves from his father. But while he was a student at William and Mary, he came under the tutelage of abolitionists and believed that slaves ought to be freed. And so he agreed to free his slaves, or he didn't agree, against his brothers' and parents' wishes. When he inherited his slaves, he freed them on his way to Illinois. But he failed to pay put $500 bonds on each of those slaves that he freed. And a few years later, he was sued and found guilty and had to pay a $2,000 fine. Fortunately, a few years later, that fine was rescinded. But in each of his three messages to the General Assembly, he recommended the repeal of those repressive laws relating to slavery and indentured servitude. His first message was again referred to a special committee, where when it was reported out, the committee reported that all slaves currently held were protected under the Northwest Ordinance by language too plain and forcible to be misunderstood. The number of African Americans living in Illinois during Lincoln's years in the state, according to the U.S. Census, peaked at 7,628, probably grossly undercounted. Less than one half of 1%. When he first arrived in the state, the population of African Americans, percentage-wise, was three times larger, although it was only 2,384. Despite the disproportionately small number of African Americans in Illinois, their presence created an outsized negative reaction among the state's citizens. Over the next several years, African Americans became subject of increasingly oppressive laws. By 1845, the state enacted laws that required all persons of color to carry their freedom papers at all times, prohibited intermarriage with whites, fined any official who participated in such marriage, and barred them from holding public office thereafter. Prohibited blacks and mulattoes from testifying in court for or against a white man, voting or holding office, serving in the militia, and denied their children admission to public schools, and prohibited the gathering of three or more without permission from their master, and subjected them to punishment if found more than 10 miles from home. In addition, servants could not sell things without their master's permission, and punishment included whippings with cat of nine tails, among others, on bare backs, fines, and standing in stocks. Many other laws contained provisos that demeaned them, or in the terms of the day, degraded African Americans. As example, the ordinary indenture laws for children for the state required that they be taught to read and write. But African American children were exempted from that proviso. Every African American found without his freedom papers could be incarcerated. The offender was to be sold on the front steps of the courthouse month to month for 1 year. At the close of that year, if nobody claimed him or her, he was to have his freedom papers, always subject to being re-enslaved if a master reappeared any time after they had their freedom papers. Illinoisans were also hostile to runaway slaves, and there were a lot of runaway slaves who passed through Illinois. Rewards for their capture ranged from $10 to $200 to $500, and in one case I saw an ad for $1,000 reward. The oppression experienced by black men and women continued unabated until the Civil War and beyond. Slavery itself was formally terminated in 1845 when the last French slave was liberated by the Illinois Supreme Court, although there were still a few slaves being held illegally, if you can believe the newspapers. 2 years later, Illinoisans decided the Constitution was outdated and called a new constitutional convention. Many Illinoisans, particularly in the northern half of the state, and particularly in Cook County, were strongly pro-slavery by this time. One delegate to the Constitutional Convention even had the temerity to suggest African Americans be allowed the elective franchise. That was quickly postponed. Rather than ameliorate conditions for African Americans, the delegates chose to write the black laws into the Constitution with additional oppressive measures. This included an article to be voted on separately requiring the next General Assembly to pass a law or laws that would effectively prohibit African American immigration into the state. Both the Constitution and that immigration article, which was voted on separately, passed overwhelmingly. The separate article received 50,261 votes to 21,297. The required act was introduced in the next General Assembly, but it failed to pass. 2 years, 4 years later, John A. Logan from Southern Illinois, Murfreesboro, introduced the measure that incorporated all the previous provisions of the black laws, and in addition, it did absolutely prohibit African American immigration. If an African American came into Illinois and stayed more than 10 days, he was subject to arrest, a $50 fine, and sale as before. If he did not leave after he had served his time, the fine was doubled, and each time he failed to leave, it was doubled again. This law was enforced, and some arrested were purchased and sold south. This draconian law continued in force until February 1865, and was enforced in Hancock County as late as 1863. Charles Zucker, in a dissertation written more than 35 years ago, has detailed how Illinois' white society humiliated and degraded African Americans. He noted that blacks were almost universally shunted into occupations that provided little financial or aesthetical reward. In a canvass of the 1850 census, of selected counties, he found that nearly 46% of black family heads were unemployed. Approximately 25% had found employment as common laborers, and another 13% toiled at occupations that required only a limited degree of training, working as cooks, waiters, stewards, porters, boatsmen, teamsters, draymen, miners, seamstresses, and barbers. Less than 5% of black family heads, on the other hand, worked as skilled laborers or tradesmen. Although 10% were engaged in agriculture, few owned their own farms. The black community, moreover, lacked business, and professional a business and professional class, and in 1850 only 1% of the black family heads were employed in the professions. The free Negro community then was deprived of an important means of economic growth and access to invaluable services. Even those who served as ministers and teachers were relegated to the above occupation in order to keep body and soul together. As noted earlier, black students, black children were barred from most schools, public or private. Even though a black child was occasionally enrolled in a white school, their stay was often short-lived if a white parent objected. As example, James H. McGee, born in Shipman, Illinois, recorded for a brief period of time that he and his siblings attended a local white school. But when a parent objected, they were withdrawn, and after some searching, they discovered that there was a school in Racine, Wisconsin, that accepted African-American students. And so they went from Shipman to Racine, Wisconsin, and where they stayed for 3 years and graduated from a mixed race high school. Regardless of their occupation or status in the community in which they lived, especially in Egypt, free blacks faced the threat of kidnapping and being sold south as slaves. In 1827, Martha Prater moved from Tennessee with 23 slaves to Gallatin County. These slaves ranged in age from 1 to 33. And she brought them there for the purpose of freeing them. In doing so, she posted a bond of $23,000. In 1844, three Tennesseans discovered this group of ex-slaves and said that their freedom papers were bogus. And so they captured 28. There were now 60 of these ex-Prater slaves because of marriage and children. So they were captured and put in jail in Gallatin County. Fortunately, some local people knew the Prater slaves and managed to get them freed, and so they were not sent into slavery. But their story was one of the good stories. Most other stories were not so good. Even in northern Illinois, there were examples of notorious anti-black prejudice, inspired in part, no doubt, by the Dred Scott decision and the recession of 1857. Some residents in Amboy, Lee County, Illinois, began to harass a recently arrived black barber described as a mulatto man. He had successfully competed for business with a German barber. He was threatened, arrested more than once on trumped up charges, and finally arrested for being in violation of the state's black laws. Fortunately, he escaped from town. He left town before his trial. Still, from time to time, there were chinks in Illinois' notorious anti-black attitudes. Beginning in 1830, the Underground Railroad, in which both blacks and sympathetic whites were active, uncounted slaves, mostly from neighboring states, passed through Illinois on their way to Canada or stopping in Chicago. In 1837, the Illinois General Assembly not only allowed Free Frank, the black founder of New Philadelphia, Illinois, in Pike County, to choose a surname, McWhirter, and permitted him to sue and be sued, be impleaded, purchase, and convey both real and personal property. Very unusual. Other blacks who found financial success in Illinois included such individuals as William Florville, the Springfield barber and friend of Lincoln, John Jones, a Chicago tailor and black community leader, and his colleague in Chicago, Henry O. Wagoner, a prominent hominy manufacturer. Both the latter men were friends of Frederick Douglass, as well as John Brown and some of his conspirators. But even these relatively well-known and respected individuals were subjected to subtle and blatant indignities. William Florville's real name was William de Florville, but he was identified as Billy or Billy the Barber. Now, some might think that was just a note of familiarity, but I suggest that it denoted a lack of respect. When John Jones of Chicago was on a speaking tour of Northern Illinois and Southern Wisconsin with Frederick Douglass and H. Ford Douglass, they were purposely ill-treated in a restaurant. And here's how Frederick Douglass described the scene. The landlord, a rampant Democrat, wishing to signalize his devotion to the Dred Scott decision and to slavery generally, caused a table to be set at the extreme end of the dining room with two hall doors and a street door open directly on the bonus. The table was covered with dirty and ragged tablecloth, and the whole appearance of the breakfast preparations made to resemble Negro fare on a slave plantation. We, with our friends H. Ford Douglass and John Jones, seeing that the whole thing was a premeditated attempt to degrade and insult us, paid our bills and went to another hotel. Henry Wagner experienced a similar indignity. Here's what he said. I stepped into a drugstore on northeast corner of Dearborn and Lake Streets respectfully, as I had done several times before, and asked for a glass of soda. No one happening to be waiting, a slim, black, mustached, French-looking man told me he would not serve me. Why, said I. I have the money for it. We don't want to sell to any but white folks. Many Illinoisans, including Abraham Lincoln, believed in African-American inferiority and thought both races would be better off if they were separated. During most of his adult life, he supported colonization, as did a large proportion of his peers. Even some African-Americans agreed with him. As early as 1818, Abraham Camp, who lived in southern Illinois, a black man, wrote to the American Colonization Society that he and his family and others were willing to leave America whenever the way shall be opened. We love this country and its liberties if we could share an equal right in them. But our freedom is partial and it will ever be otherwise here. Next to the uproar over the fugitive slave law, the Dred Scott decision fomented more strife than any other action related to race relations after the passage of the Black Code of 1853. Although many white Illinoisans approved the Dred Scott decision, more seemed to oppose it. Illinois' African American community denounced it vigorously, but the black law continued to be the bitterest pill for African Americans. At a state convention shortly after the 1856 presidential election, black leaders met to concentrate their efforts on the repeal of the odious laws. Their complaints included being taxed without the right to vote, denied the right to testify against a white man, and perhaps most galling, we pay school taxes without the privilege of sending our children to public schools. At the conclusion, they created a statewide repeal association in order to try to convince Illinoisans to end this practice. There was one more major effort on the part of Illinois Negrophobes to maintain white hegemony in the state. At the 1860 general election, the calling of a constitutional convention was on the ballot. It succeeded and delegates were elected in November 1861. The convention convened in 1862, and the convention debates were and although the convention debates were contentious, they eventually adopted a constitution that remained Negrophobic. For our purposes, the most important were three articles to be submitted separately. They were 1, absolute prohibition of African American settlement in the state; 2, prohibition of black voting or office holding; and 3, the requirement that the General Assembly pass the necessary laws to enforce these articles. While the Constitution passed overwhelmingly, or failed overwhelmingly, those three articles passed overwhelmingly. The Civil War was winding down. As the Civil War was winding down, it became increasingly clear that slavery was ending in the nation, and there was talk in Congress and elsewhere about African American rights. and their position in the emerging new nation. Led by John Jones, Illinois African Americans renewed their efforts at joining the body politic. In late 1864, he published his classic, The Black Laws of Illinois and a Few Reasons Why They Ought to Be Repealed. During that fall and winter, Jones and other African Americans gathered signatures of thousands of white Illinoisans in support of the petition to repeal the laws. On January 5, 1865, Francis Eastman of Cook County submitted a petition praying for the repeal of the Black Laws that was 125 feet long, containing 7,000 signatures and representing $20 million in property. The bill had already been submitted, and after much debate, the bill became law, and Richard Oglesby signed it into law on February 7. Did this mean there were no more problems while Illinois, between white Illinoisans and their African American counterparts? No. I think maybe, however, a Civil War soldier, G.W. Adams, spoke for many white Illinoisans when he wrote to his brother Rich, "I am sorry to say that Negroes are put on an equality, on equally with a white man in this Illinois. So now a Negro has as good a right to vote as a white man." If only that had been so. Thank you.
Thank you all for coming tonight. It's a great honor to be here, and I thank you, Michael, and Chancellor at UIS for the invitation to be here. And thank you, Roger, for an outstanding paper. I think it'll be an interesting conversation between our two papers. It is one of the curiosities of the 1858 Lincoln-Douglas debates that the content of the debates was so focused on slavery and race. After all, slavery was not legal in Illinois, and there were a very small number of free blacks in the state based on the census in 1860. There were a small number above 7,600, but that was a tiny fraction of the total population that was over 1.7 million, less than one half of 1%. Yet despite this, the debaters talked extensively about both subjects. And additionally, over the 5 months that they were traversing the state in the summer and fall of 1858, they spoke about these subjects in their own speeches repeatedly to the audiences that they saw. So what accounts for that? What accounts for the apparent interest of Illinois voters in these issues that didn't seem to be particularly germane to Illinois society? The answer, in short, is that the United States was facing a crisis over the meaning of freedom. It was a battle that had been undergone for 70 years, but it was emerging as an issue that could not be resolved without being directly addressed by major political figures. Like other politicians of the time, therefore, Lincoln and Douglas needed to articulate the relationship of slavery and freedom. But to do that, they had to talk about the relationship between race and slavery. And in order to do both of those things, they had to wrestle with the Southern definition of freedom. It's characteristic for both scholars of the Civil War and for the common public to think about Southerners being pro-slavery and Northerners being anti-slavery, and as a generalization, that's largely accurate. But in some ways, it's more useful to think about the sectional conflict being between two different interpretations of freedom. Northerners thought of freedom as conjoining personal independence and national progress, that individuals who were free would pursue their economic opportunity, opportunity for moral self-advancement, and by their energies to do these things, the society itself would push forward. By that logic, slavery was the antithesis of freedom. The master's despotism over the slave not only held the slave in check, but it held the society in check as well, because those individuals couldn't grow, they couldn't get educated, they couldn't pursue their interests, they couldn't use their energies to the benefit of the broader community. But Southerners didn't see slavery in that way. They had no similar critique of slavery. Instead, they thought that slavery bolstered freedom. Slavery made possible the economic opportunities for white men and white families, made it better to be a housewife who had someone who could serve in cooking, making the fire. Slavery made it possible for white men to be equal, to have political equality in the South. So from the Southern standpoint, slavery was not alien to freedom. It was part of it. Hence, they expressed their desire and indeed their determination to take slavery to the West and hopefully the South. They wanted to expand it because they saw it was beneficial both for themselves and, they believed, for the nation. So this difference between the Northern and the Southern idea of freedom was something that Lincoln and Douglas had to confront in the debates of 1858. And it's important to comprehend that divergent understandings of property rights were at the basis of those different understandings of freedom. In the decades after the ratification of the Constitution, the Northern states passed gradual emancipation laws. That meant eventually those states would be free. They were like sunset clauses. They didn't free all the slaves right then at that moment, but they ensured that the children of slaves would be freed, and so the society itself would be a free society. During those same decades after the Constitution's adoption, the Southern states did exactly the opposite, regulating manumission, which means the ability of slave owners to free their own slaves, regulating manumission to make it more difficult because they didn't want free blacks populating their states and undermining slavery. Now, the broad consequence of those two different legislative patterns meant that you had an emergence of legislative blocks of states functioning in Congress who had very different approaches to any issue that involved slavery. So in the antebellum decades, as these blocks emerged and voted as blocks for the most part, there were a number of conflicts over slavery that were revealed. Roger has mentioned some of them, like the transit of masters with their slaves through free states. That was something that was very irritating to slaveholders when Northerners said those people shouldn't be permitted to come through our states voluntarily. They're not fugitives, so they're free. If you've brought them here voluntarily, they are not fugitives, and they must be free because our state doesn't recognize property in man. Correspondingly, Southerners were determined that fugitive slaves should be returned as rapidly as possible. But Northerners again responded, well, wait a minute, you shouldn't take back our free citizens potentially into slavery, so there needs to be legal protections to make sure your slave catchers don't take back free people into the South and make them slaves perpetually. Well, again, that was because of a presumption that there was no property rights in man in the North, and so the free blacks in the North, even the small number in Illinois, were free men. They were not slaves, and predominantly Northerners did not endorse the idea that there should be property in man. So all of these conflicts over slavery, at their core, reflected a radically divergent perspective on whether or not there should be property in man. The history of Illinois, as Roger has suggested, revealed this issue of the property in man with a special clarity. After all, it was supposed to be dedicated to freedom by the Northwest Ordinance, yet in fact, Southern slaveholders who came into territorial Illinois brought slaves, because that's how they made money and that's how they made their fires, helped their wives. and they didn't want to leave them behind, and they certainly didn't want to lose them when they came to Illinois. And so, as Roger has mentioned, they created territorial indenture laws that ensured that their slaves would be property under a different name. And when they created the state constitution, they created a legal loophole that made it possible, subsequently, for the state to legalize slavery. This was a striking difference from the Ohio and Indiana state constitutions, which had not permitted that possibility. So it's very likely it was a deliberate omission because they copied many clauses from Illinois and Ohio as it was. And indeed, a few years later, there was a massive attempt by pro-slavery forces in the state to change the legal status of the state so that there could be property in man. They almost succeeded, they probably would have, except for two factors: a huge mobilization of anti-slavery forces both within the state and without it, and the migration of settlers to Illinois who believed in freedom and did not wish to come to a slave state. In other words, since 1818, before the critical vote on this proposed amendment, proposed convention that could make an amendment to the Constitution, which occurred in 1824, in this 6 years, there was a surge of voters who voted anti-slavery. And without that, the state's future might have been radically different. But as it was a crucial moment in the history of Illinois. Not a turning point, rather a non-turning point, because the state maintained its freedom. It did not adopt property in man, which was what those who wanted slavery would have done to the Constitution of Illinois. That continued status of freedom in Illinois meant that, like the other northern states that had adopted gradual emancipation, Illinois would one day be an entirely free state. But its consecration to freedom did not eliminate conflicts over slavery. Most notably, Elijah P. Lovejoy, the abolitionist editor of a newspaper in Alton, Illinois, was shot down by a pro-slavery mob led by the city leaders, who considered him fanatical and dangerous. They were worried about both Alton's reputation, the trade it sustained with St. Louis and other Mississippi River towns connected to the slave economy, and they were worried for the nation's perpetuity, for its unification. And they knew that Southerners by that point were becoming a cohesive bloc on slavery. It was pretty evident in a lot of ways, among them in Southern state legislatures' request of Northern legislators that Northern state legislatures denounce abolitionism. So Alton's leaders decided to contribute to that effort by silencing an abolitionist in their midst. But the conflict over the meaning of freedom in the country made that impossible. Silencing abolitionists didn't solve a problem that was rooted in different understandings of freedom that were themselves rooted in different understandings of what should be property. So the fundamental problem could never be resolved unless either Northerners or Southerners gave up their understanding of freedom and adopted the other side's. But that was extremely unlikely because both of them had so much stake in their existing social orders. For the Southerners to give up their idea, for instance, would wipe out the second largest amount of property in the country behind only land. It's almost inconceivable that they would have done that. So all of this meant that the challenge that slavery presented to the nation was going to percolate until there was a final resolution. This was true for even the many supporters of union, those like Alton's leaders who wanted to do everything they could to preserve it. Stephen A. Douglas was most certainly one of these individuals. He was a leader of Illinois' Democratic Party. He had midwifed its birth in the 1830s, and he remained its chief wire puller until his death in 1861. And his party, unlike the abolitionists, but very much like Douglas, sought to mute conflicts over slavery. They were much more interested in trying to promote the economic opportunities that they wanted whites to benefit from in the antebellum period. So they typically promoted, among other things, national expansion, because this seemed the best thing for a society of farmers. Cheap land was a fantastic way to both subsist, benefit from rising land values, and ultimately be able to benefit from trade once markets developed around you. So nothing better than to take land from Indians, organize it into territories, and later run railroads through it. It was fantastic both for individuals and for the country. And that was what was called progress if you were a Democrat. So in the 1840s, Illinois Democrats, like other Northern Democrats and Southern Democrats, pushed for national expansion. Ideally, they wanted it literally everywhere, but it ended up focusing towards the Southwest and rather than the Northwest, which was somewhat irritating to Democrats. President Polk kind of cut a deal with the British so that they got some of the territory that Democrats thought should be ours. And Polk was interested in getting out of trouble with the world's greatest power so that he could pick on Mexico. And the result ultimately was a war with Mexico that produced a massive land cession known as the Mexican Cession in the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo in 1848. Fascinatingly, though, here again, the nation's conflict in trying to understand what freedom was came to the fore. The unity that had brought the Democrats together to push for expansion shattered immediately. In fact, even before the Mexican Cession was realized, in the midst of war, a Democratic legislator attached a proviso to a funding bill saying, when we get the land from Mexico, because no one doubted we would, it's all got to be free. Why did they say that? Because they wanted it to be free soil territory, and free soil territory by definition meant there would not be property rights in man. Southerners and Southern Democrats were furious and responded in no uncertain terms that this was totally unacceptable. It was a gross violation of their property rights under the United States Constitution. The divide between Northern and Southern Democrats reflected the divide between Northerners and Southerners, and it helped precipitate a bitter four-year battle in Congress from 1846 to 1850. And in that four-year battle, the debates by congressmen made abundantly clear that there were radically divergent understandings of the meaning of freedom between Northerners and Southerners. Which brings us to Stephen A. Douglas, because in these debates, he sought very much to find a middle ground. He wanted to calm the storm, and there was certainly serious concern for disunion because the Southerners, as they had at the Constitutional Convention, the most radical Georgians and South Carolinians then, and Southerners ever since, when there were big issues that came afoot regarding slavery, said, if you do not give us our way, we will pick up our toys and go home. So that issue was on the table. Douglas hated the concept of it and sought above all to resolve this problem. So in the clip that follows from my film, we will hear from Stephen A. Douglas. What we will see is that he's really concerned with actually defending Northern Democrats from Southern pro-slavery demands, because of course they're in the middle of the abolitionists and the Southern radicals, neither of whom he liked very much because they both threatened the Union in his view. And here is his response.
No sympathy for abolitionism on the one side, or that extreme course on the other which is akin to abolitionism. In the North, it is not expected that we should take the position that slavery is a positive good, a positive blessing. If we did assume such a position, it would be a very pertinent inquiry. Why do you not adopt this institution? We have molded our institutions at the North as we have thought proper. And now we say to you of the South, if slavery be a blessing, it is your blessing. If it be a curse, it is your curse. Enjoy it. On you rest all the responsibility.
Well, we'll have to go with the audio of Stephen Douglas because the movie does work very well, but not right now. So I think it's because of the delay. They told me they were worried if we waited for an hour, it was going to reset, and it happened, apparently. So we're going to get 4 audio clips from Douglas, I suspect. So listen to him carefully. As he was saying here, he preferred the Northern definition of freedom. He was not willing to endorse the positive good view of slavery that had first been articulated politically by John C. Calhoun on the floor of the Senate in 1837, and it later became Southern Orthodoxy. But while he wasn't willing to give them a positive good endorsement of it, what he really wanted was for the nation to bury their disagreement on slavery, to put off having to make an adjudication nationally of what that definition of slavery would be. From his standpoint, slavery was a Southern matter. It was not a national concern. It was their concern, and that meant that Northerners should simply keep their hands off. And in concert with that, Douglas endorsed a territorial policy that would essentially enable the territorial problem to also accommodate the competing definitions of freedom. His plan in this regard, and it was not only his, it was the Northern Democratic plan in the 1848 presidential election, called at the time Congressional Non-Intervention with Slavery, later called popular sovereignty, meaning that the settlers in a territory would decide whether or not property in man would be legalized in their emerging state. Here's what he says in 1849. Maybe if we're lucky, we'll see some pictures move.
If we wish to settle this question of slavery, let us banish the agitation from these halls. Let us remove the causes which produce it. Let us settle it in the territory we have acquired, in a manner to satisfy the honor and respect the feelings of every portion of the Union. Do not insult one section of the Union by bringing forward your prohibition of slavery, nor defy the other by threats of disunion. Bring those territories into this Union as states upon an equal footing with the original states. Let the people of such states settle the question of slavery within their limits, as they would settle the question of banking or any other domestic institution, according to their own will.
So Douglas's proposition, although certainly controversial, is ultimately adopted. He's the architect, I think it could fairly be called, of the Compromise of 1850. If you had to select one man most responsible for its passage after an extremely acrimonious congressional session, it was Douglas. The Utah and New Mexico territorial bills incorporate popular sovereignty and resolve probably the most critical issue in the debates over slavery that produced the Compromise of 1850. So this is a great triumph for Douglas, yet fascinatingly, most Northern congressmen don't like this result. 38% support popular sovereignty, which gives some indication of how strongly they adhere to the Northern definition of freedom. With the country's peace at stake, with 4 years of battling over this issue, Southerners threatening disunion, and by almost a 2-to-1 margin, most still don't want to vote for popular sovereignty. They don't want slavery to have a chance to climb into more of the nation's territories. But Douglas is very happy with this result. Not only politically is it a great triumph, but very importantly, it preserves the Union, which to him is of enormous significance. And of course, it achieves what he hopes might be a long-term goal of pushing off this issue of deciding which definition of freedom has to prevail. As he will later say in his debates with Lincoln, this republic can exist forever divided into free and slave states. Now, most of us today are probably glad that the republic has not persisted forever as free and slave states. Whatever our problems are now, that would be worse. We would have many of the very serious problems that historians of the 19th century are well aware of, because we would literally be dealing with the problem of property in man as they were then. It could not be limited to only one part of the country. It would be difficult to do so, including if you simply wanted to visit Alabama. It'd have a different tinge to it than it does now. So it's a bit ironic, one of the great ironies of American history, that perhaps the man most responsible for preventing slavery from still existing is the same figure named Stephen A. Douglas. Because in 1854, as is well known, he's the architect of another extraordinarily important bill, the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which organizes most of the Great Plains using his same popular sovereignty formula, which may have been fine, except for the fact that it already had been pledged to freedom by the Missouri Compromise in 1820, which had precluded property in man from going into those territories. Now, he did it for a variety of reasons. I'm not going to go through that fully. If you would like to find out what I have to say, you can always read my book and read it to your heart's content. But suffice it to say for now, the most important fact is that it goes through mainly because he wants to organize Western territories, and Southerners were not willing to give him the votes to do that because they knew they would be free territories leading to free states unless that anti-slavery provision was overthrown. So they just wouldn't vote for it, and they had enough votes to block the organization of the territories entirely. But that kind of makes it useless if the nation has the territories, because they're sitting out there filled with Indians, no settlers, no railroads, no transcontinental railroad, no commerce uniting the country, no shattering of space by the speed of the railroads. So he wants to break that up. He wants to get the country all the way to the Pacific, not with ships, you know, running around, you know, huge journeys to get to California from New York, which was incredibly difficult and expensive and slow. And so he pushes for this measure. He gets the Southerners to agree by striking out the anti-slavery provision, but it's extraordinarily costly. Northerners are enraged. He says that he can travel from Washington, D.C. to Chicago by the light of his own burning effigies that are hung up on the railway lines. The bill takes 5 months to pass through Congress. There's public demonstrations throughout the North, more than there had ever been. No doubt, the most dramatic mobilization of Democratic sentiment in the history of the country. And yet, despite this, almost unanimous Southern support for the bill thrusts it barely through both houses of Congress. But the anti-slavery movement begins to rise. It had already been growing. It had been silenced by the Compromise of 1850. But now suddenly anti-slavery Democrats, and they were a part of that party, anti-slavery Whigs like Lincoln, abolitionists, even anti-slavery immigrants and anti-slavery nativists who otherwise might not have liked each other very much, they're all protesting against this bill, and eventually, it takes a while, they congeal into the Republican Party, which in Illinois is going to be led by none other than Abraham Lincoln. And the rise of this party is enormously important because it will unapologetically advocate for the Northern definition of freedom. And this means that from that point onwards, Stephen A. Douglas has got to talk about slavery and race, because he is being criticized endlessly for being pro-slavery. At this point, race and slavery become the central political issues in Illinois and throughout the North. Even before the bill is passed, in mid-February of 1854, Douglas writes the following, bitterly denouncing his political opponents, writes a public letter denouncing them for saying that my bill, quote, opens that whole country, i.e. the Great Plains, to slavery? Why do they not state the matter truly and say that it opens the country to freedom by leaving people perfectly free to do as they please? This language shows more clearly than almost any he could have selected how profound the difference was between the northern and southern definitions of freedom. Because while again he did not talk about a positive good of slavery, he implicitly incorporated the right to property in man into his understanding of what could happen in the territories, and thus he adopted the southern definition of freedom. He was angry at his opponents, but they were his opponents precisely because they absolutely refused to accept that there should be property in man. They understood there could be, and they wanted to oppose it at any cost. But the Southern definition of freedom had another element. It was not just property in man. That was essential. But it also required a racial justification for enslaving blacks rather than others. Because if you took that out, you could enslave whites, and it would serve all the same function, and property in man could handle that without difficulty. So only with a racial justification could it be black slavery rather than white slavery. In the same letter in February, Lincoln addresses this part of the doctrine as well.
Now, let it be borne in mind that every abolitionist and free soiler who opposes the Nebraska bill avows his willingness to support it, provided that slavery shall be forever prohibited therein. They are willing to allow the people to legislate for themselves in relation to husband and wife, parent and child, master and servant, and guardian and ward, so far as white persons are to be affected, but seem to think that it requires a higher degree of civilization and refinement to legislate for the Negro race than can reasonably be expected the people of a territory to possess. Is this position well founded? Does it require any greater capacity or keener sense of moral rectitude to legislate for the black man than for the white man?
Douglass's arguments were subtle, but powerful. Essentially, what he's saying is that there was no fundamental difference between slavery and the many other kinds of subordination that existed in American society. Women were subordinate to men, wives particularly were subordinate to husbands, children were subordinate to parents. So if that's the case, how is slavery so different? Why would you rule it out? And especially not if you've got black laws throughout a lot of northern states and blacks are not treated equally. We just heard how profoundly unequally they were treated in this state. And so Douglass says, what's the distinction really between northern black laws and slavery? To him, it's a distinction without a difference, and he will labor for the next 6 years to impress that upon the northern mind. Because if you can erase that distinction, then you open up the door for the idea of property rights in man. Over those 6 years, however, he would also become more explicit and more forceful in his condemnations of blacks as an inferior race. He becomes unquestionably one of the leading race baiters in the North. By 1858, for instance, he routinely compares black people to crocodiles. He does not do that to equate them exactly with crocodiles, but rather he says, as white people are to black people, so black people are to crocodiles. Although he doesn't use the word black in many cases. And so his point is clear. There is a subordination, and that subordination goes from the human to the animal, and at best, black people are in the middle of that tier of living beings. And since the black person can kill a crocodile, this is a very alarming comparison to make. This was one of his relatively tame comments. In the debates, he never brings up the crocodiles. He says that in Illinois, but not during the debates because he knows they're recorded. But he says things like this.
I care more for the great principle of self-government, the right of the people to rule, than I do for all the Negroes in Christendom. I would not endanger the perpetuity of this Union. I would not blot out the great inalienable rights of the white men for all the Negroes that ever existed.
So this doctrine was very powerful. Douglass was willing to take these racial ideas and bring them into concert with the Southern definition of freedom. He didn't ever make the positive good defense of slavery the Southerners did all the time by this period, but he did believe that the rights of blacks should be decided by whites. They had no natural rights that had to be respected at all. In this, he was in complete agreement with the Chief Justice of the United States, Roger B. Taney, whose Dred Scott decision sought to drive home this exact same doctrine. To Lincoln, Douglass's doctrines on race and slavery contradicted both natural law and national principles. Consequently, he sharply contested Douglass's racial arguments. In the sixth debate at Quincy on October 13, 1858, Lincoln conceded that he preferred the white race to have, quote, the superior position if there must be a difference between the races. But he immediately added, quote, that notwithstanding all this, there is no reason in the world why the Negro is not entitled to all of the rights enumerated in the Declaration of Independence, the right of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I hold that he, the Negro, is as much entitled to these as the white man, in the right to eat the bread without leave of anybody else, which his own hand earns. He is my equal, and the equal of Judge Douglas, and the equal of every other man. 2 days later, in the final debate at Alton, Lincoln returned to the Declaration of Independence by denouncing Douglas, who had claimed again that the signers of the Declaration had, quote, no reference to Negroes at all when they declared all men were created equal. Lincoln announced that he would combat this proposition. I combat it, he said, as having a tendency to dehumanize the Negro, to take away from him the right of ever striving to be a man. I combat it as being one of the thousand things constantly done these days to prepare the public mind to make property and nothing but property of the Negro in all states of this Union. And this was not new with Lincoln. In his famous Peoria address in 1854, he had made essentially the same arguments, pointing out that the fact there were free blacks in the South, which there were, had occurred because many, many slave owners, certainly a small minority of the whole, but many in the thousands manumitted their slaves in the wake of the Revolution because they believed it was wrong. And they didn't themselves wish to continue in the wrong. And he said, if we're moving away from that doctrine, we are moving away from the founders' ideals. And he said, in criticism of Douglass's comments about crocodiles. He said that Douglass and the Democrats were making brutes out of men. Correspondingly, Lincoln was a powerful and articulate spokesperson against slavery. By his logic, slavery was a gross violation of freedom and should be put in the course, in his words, of ultimate extinction. What that meant was eventual abolition, not immediate, but ideally a sunset clause that ultimately will take effect. Therefore, he took sharp issue with Douglass on the issue of slavery. He observed that Douglass, quote, contends that whatever community wants slaves has a right to them. So they have, said Lincoln, if it is not a wrong. But if it is a wrong, Douglass cannot say that people have a right to do wrong. He says that upon the score of equality, i.e., the equality of property owners in the South, that slaves should be allowed to go into new territory like other property. This is strictly logical if there is no difference between slaves and other property. But if you insist that one is wrong and the other right, then there is no use to institute a comparison between right and wrong. Insisting that the founders had endorsed the Northern definition of freedom, that it did not include property rights in man, which is why the Constitution doesn't have a word about property rights in man, and refers to people held to labor, which was a deliberate choice of language by a generation that had hoped, certainly, that slavery would one day die. Lincoln told Northerners that the proper path was to reinstate restrictions on slavery's growth so that it one day would die. As he argued, quote, the sentiment that contemplates the institution of slavery in this country as a wrong is the sentiment of the Republican Party. It is the sentiment around which all their actions, all their arguments circle, and from which all their propositions radiate. Republicans insist that slavery should, as far as may be treated as a wrong. Thank you.